The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. If you have any questions or would like to become a sponsor of this program or any other programs, please contact our office at 919-832-5138. Okay, last week we were going over America the Tasty. The Reader's Digest Taste of Home asked people across the country to pick the most delicious food in every state. And we had left off with Louisiana. Just a little refresher in case you don't remember, Louisiana's signature dish was gumbo. Let me just say, gumbo is the food of the gods. All the variations of gumbo reflect the many origins and cultures of the people of Louisiana. That's from Ann Maverick in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Who knew? The po' boy sandwich was born during the strike of 1929, when 1,800 streetcar conductors and motormen took to the streets of New Orleans. The Martin Brothers coffee stand and restaurant provided large sandwiches for free to the poor boys. Today you can order a po' boy with roast beef or fried seafood. Now we move to the new ones. Maine, signature dish? Of course, it's a lobster roll with a toasted, buttered, split-top bun, and there's a picture of one there, and it does look good. Who knew? Maine's official state treat is the whoopie pie. The secret is in the filling, which is cooked. Sour milk and real shortening are involved, but I cannot divulge the recipe. Oh, no, lest my sisters and I lose our reputations for the best whoopie pies in the country. Heidi Sweetwater, Farmington, Maine. Maryland, the signature dish is crab cakes. The best is when you go crabbing and the head home to steam the crabs yourself. Beer, not water, and plenty of Old Bay seasoning. There was much screaming when the crab missed the pot and hit the floor. I never saw my children move so fast. Who knew? Maryland state dessert, Smith Island cake, dates back to the 1800s when women made multi-layered yellow cakes to send along with their husbands when they went oystering. And there's a picture of the cake, and it has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 layers. Although they're thin layers. Massachusetts. The signature dish is Boston baked beans. Originating from Native Americans, the slow-cooked dish is flavored with molasses or maple syrup and bacon. The Puritans made it on the Sabbath. Who knew? The town of Quincy isn't known as the birthplace of the American dream for nothing. It was the original home of not one, but two fast food icons, Howard Johnson's and Dunkin' Donuts. Maryland, the signature dish, Michigan, meat pasties. These came from Cornish copper miners on Michigan's Upper Peninsula. It's a circle of pie crust filled with minced beef, potatoes, onions, carrots, and rutabaga, then folded in half, crimped, and baked. Sometimes the wives of the miners left room for a small corner of the pastry to put chopped apple, sugar, and cinnamon for a fast bite as dessert. Who knew? John Harvey Kellogg was the king of cornflakes, but he was almost as famous for his Michigan-based sanitarium and health spa. Among its patients, Henry Ford, Thomas Edison, and President William Howard Taft. Minnesota. The signature dish was hot dish, a casserole made with cream of mushroom soup, vegetables, meat, and starch such as tater tots. My dad didn't like vegetables in his hot dish, so my mom would leave them out. I was baffled when I had my first tater tot hot dish with vegetables in it at the age of 20. That's from Sonia Okerman, St. Cloud, Minnesota. Who knew? Betty Crocker isn't real, but that didn't stop this fictional spokesperson, a creation of the Washburn Crosby Company in Minneapolis, later bought by General Mills, from being named the second most popular woman in the nation in 1945, right behind Eleanor Roosevelt. Mississippi. Signature dish is catfish. These days, catfish are mainly raised on farms. Mississippi is home to more than half of the catfish farms in the United States. Who knew? It gets plenty hot on the bayou. During the late 1920s, Mississippians would beat the heat by sinking their feet in the mud of the river. Somehow, that became the inspiration for Mississippi mud pie, whose dense chocolate resembles the river's muddy bank. Missouri. Signature dish is barbecue. Kansas City is known for its barbecue, and the Show Me State's first barbecue establishment, opened in 1908, was actually run out of a trolley barn. Also big in Kansas City, Burnt Ents. The outer parts of a smoked beef brisket cut into small chunks with the delicious outer smoked char and the succulent inner meat. Who knew? Do you suffer from frequent heartburn? Perhaps from too much barbecue? So did Nellie Acuff Howe. Her husband, St. Louis pharmacist James Howe, invented Tums for her in 1928. Montana. Signature dish is chicken fried steak, which is dipped in egg and flour and then fried, and is often served with white gravy. Who knew? Rocky Mountain oysters, also known as mountain tenderloins, and cowboy caviar, euphemisms all. This dish is made from the testicles of a young bull. That's what it's turned into a steer. They don't throw anything out. Nebraska. The signature dish is runza, R-U-N-Z-A, a pocket sandwich similar to Kansas beer rocks with extra cabbage. The sandwich chain runza, a Midwestern favorite, got its start in Lincoln. Who knew? In 1953, Omaha-based C.A. Swanson and Sons overestimated demand for Thanksgiving turkey and found itself with 260 extra tons of frozen birds. The solution? Ordering 5,000 trays and assembling the first TV dinners, complete with cornbread, dressing, gravies, peas, and sweet potatoes. Nevada. The signature dish is a shrimp cocktail. To compete with the other gambling houses in the town, Italo Gelfi, the owner of the Golden Gate Hotel and Casino, decided to bet on this seafood starter, selling it for 50 cents in 1959. It has been a conspicuously affordable Sin City staple ever since. Seems odd to have that at an inland state, though, doesn't it? Who knew? Nevada has been the home to a proud bass population since the 1800s. The bass cake, filled with cherry preserves and cream, is still a favorite way to finish a meal of Chateaubriand with Bernaise sauce. New Hampshire. The signature dish is poutine. It's not the most appetizing name, and it's actually worse when you translate the French word. It means either hodgepodge or mess. But this French-Canadian recipe for cheese curds, French fries, and gravy is justifiably Granite State's favorite. And there's a picture of it. Actually, doesn't look bad. Who knew? Samuel Kamen and Gary Hirschberg were running out of money for their organic farming school, Stonyfield Farm, in 1983. So they put their cows to work, started making yogurt, and launched a successful brand. New Jersey. The signature date is Taylor Ham. In North Jersey, it's called Taylor Ham. In South Jersey, it's called pork roll. Whatever you call it, it's delicious. Who knew? Saltwater taffy was invented in 1883 in Atlantic City. The business became so competitive that the patent dispute over taffy pulling machines went to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1921. New Mexico. Their signature dish is pork tamales. This labor-intensive dish originated in Mexico and features seasoned meat that's wrapped in cornmeal dough and then baked in husks. Who knew? Locals order their tamales red or green, depending on their chili pepper preference. Want both? Order yours Christmas style. New York. Well, of course, the signature dish is buffalo wings. This beloved appetizer was born in Buffalo's Anchor Bar in 1964. Who knew? Why do bagels have holes? So the Jewish immigrants who sold the yeasty rolls in New York City's Lower East Side at the turn of the 20th century could stack them up on sticks to take them to their customers. North Carolina. Barbecue, of course. The bar for barbecue in the Tar Heel State is high. To become a stop on the state's historic barbecue trail, pits must cook meat with wood or charcoal, make their own sauce, provide a sit-down dining experience for the public, and enjoy the high esteem of their community. But what they don't mention is there's two types of barbecue in North Carolina, the vinegar and the tomato. They should have mentioned that. That's a shame. Who knew? North Carolina produces more sweet potatoes than the other 49 states, U.S. states combined. In fact, many North Carolinians insist that sweet potato pie, not pumpkin, is the true Thanksgiving dessert. North Dakota. Signature dish. Canopha soup. K-N-O-E-P-H-I-A. Canopha soup. A comfort food made with chicken, potatoes, and dumplings. Who knew? Do you love digging in a plate of spaghetti? Spagum. Thanks to farmers in the Sioux State, a 60% of the 75 million bushels of durum wheat produced annually to make pasta is grown in North Dakota. Do you love digging into a plate of spaghetti? I'm sorry, there's a typo here. It's supposed to be spaghetti, not spaghettum. Ohio. Signature dish. Cincinnati chili. Cincinnati chili can be customized from the most basic way, chili only, but trust me, no one eats it this way, to the gold standard five-way chili. Spaghetti, beans, raw onions, and shredded cheddar. I was making this at home by the time I was 10, says Deb Bolvey. Chocolate gets messy in the summertime. So in 1912, Cleveland-based candy maker Clarence Crane came up with a sweet that could stand up to the heat. Crane borrowed a machine used by pharmacists to make pills and developed a new candy with a hole in the middle in honor of its shape. He named it a lifesaver. And there's a picture of the Cincinnati chili, and it does look good, I'll say that. Oklahoma, signature dish. In 1988, the Sooner State designated a whole official meal. Served up is chicken fried steak, sausage with biscuits and gravy, cornbread, corn fried okra, black eyed peas, barbecued pork, squash grits, and strawberries, topped off with a piece of pecan pie. Hope you're hungry. Who knew? The onion burger dates from the 1920s, when a resourceful restaurant owner fried up a pile of shredded onions to make a small hamburger go a little further. Oregon. Their signature dish is tofurkey. For decades, tofurkey has been a source of certain old-school Thanksgiving tables. But in 2018, the hood rookie Oregon-based company that makes the football-sized turkey substitute sold its 5 millionth fall Thanksgiving roast. Who knew? In 2013, Oregon became the first state to designate an official bike rub. Why? Because without the Kuromisi cervecae, Aker's brewer's yeast, you couldn't make a decent craft beer, and Oregon has more than 280 craft breweries across the state. Pennsylvania. Signature dish, of course, is the Philly cheesesteak. Except that you never say Philly or cheesesteak when ordering one. Instead, ask for a whiz-wit. Cheese whiz with fried onions, or a prove without. Provolone, no onions. Who knew? As an anti-chain chain, Shake Shack loves to localize its menus. This means that in Philadelphia, you can dig into a Liberty Shell, a cannoli shell filled with vanilla custard, strawberry puree, and lemon ricotta. Rhode Island. Signature dish are donuts. Rhode Island is home to just over 1 million people and more than 200 donut shops. Online, you can even find an 8-stop donut trail. Who knew? The Ocean State is the smallest in the Union, so perhaps it's fitting that it has an official state appetizer, calamari. South Carolina. The signature dip is shrimp and grits. It's prepared differently in many restaurants, so some serve it with a nice brown gravy, others with a spicy kick. My favorite is with peppers, onions, and bacon. Reader Cindy Van Pixitera in Somerville, South Carolina. Who knew? South Carolinians ring in the new year with the helping of Hoppin' John. This dish of rice and black-eyed peas has roots in the state's low country. Eat it with some collard greens and cornbread and feel lucky all year. South Dakota. Chislik. Bite-sized portions of beef, lamb, venison, or mutton that are grilled or deep-fried and served on a stick. And there's a picture of it here. It actually looks pretty good. Who knew? Native Americans have long eaten dried meat with cranberries for sustenance. The Oglala Lakota in the Pine Ridge Reservation updated their age-old recipe of dried buffalo meat and cranberry for the protein happy to create an energy bar called the Tanka Bar in 2006. Tennessee. Their signature dish is Nashville hot chicken, fried chicken prepared with plenty of cayenne pepper. Who knew? The Chattanooga Bakery was looking for a name for its marshmallow-filled cookie sandwiches, so a salesperson was asked some coal miners what size snack they'd like to take into the mines. One man looked up at the full moon and said, "About that big." Thus, the moon pie was born. Texas. Signature dish is pecan pie. It's pronounced pecan. No Christmas dinner is complete without a pecan pie. Who knew that the difference between Mexican and Tex-Mex food? One telltale is cumin, which is rarely used in Mexico, but a staple in Texas chili con carne. Utah, their signature dish is fry sauce. One part ketchup, two part mayo, maybe some lemon or pickle juice, and onion seasoning. Every local burger joint has fry sauce ready for you. I've seen other Utah residents try to make their own with little packets when traveling out of state. Who knew? U.S. Senator Mike Lee hosts Jell-O with the Senator every week in Washington, D.C., in honor of his home state's official snack. And there's a picture of blue Jell-O with whipped cream and a cherry on top. Vermont. Signature dish is Ben and Jerry's ice cream. Their inspired flavor, Bill freezes today. But it wasn't until Ben Greenfield got rejected from medical school and Jerry Cohen's pottery wasn't selling that they opened an ice cream shop in Burlington. Who knew? The saffron in your paella or pilaf might come from the Green Mountain State. In 2015, University of Vermont began cultivating the exotic spike, a crocus flower product. And there's pictures of several cartons of Ben and Jerry's, just making me hungry. Virginia. Signature dish are ham biscuits. Rolls filled with Virginia ham, mustard, and other seasonings. When I moved to Virginia over 30 years ago, I was introduced to ham biscuits at every gathering of Southern ladies. Alex Barrett. Who knew? Virginia and Georgia both have locations named Brunswick, and both lay claim to inventing Brunswick stew. Virginia used chickens, while Georgia offered pork and beef with hotter spices. Washington. The signature dish is grilled wild salmon, which makes sense. We have certain times when we can fish for salmon. One year I went out to the boys and got seasick. Had but one taste, and it was all worth it. In 1923, brothers Thomas and Walter Blaishaw pioneered an automated donut maker in Seattle. Krispy Kreme and Dunkin' Donuts still use Blaishaw equipment today. West Virginia. Their signature dish is pepperoni rolls. The state's favorite snack was invented for miners by an Italian immigrant. Today, three giant pepperoni rolls serve as the mascot for the West Virginia Black Beans, a minor league baseball team in Morgantown. Who knew? Come spring, West Virginian residents head to the hills in search of Bali moochers, or morel mushrooms. The forest fungi are considered a delicacy in the mountain state and beyond. Wisconsin. The signature dish is cheese curds. You will find some form of fried cheese curds at almost every restaurant, bar, and venue that serve food in Wisconsin. They're usually coated in beer batter, of course made with Wisconsin beer. Who knew? Just because Wisconsin is America's dairy land doesn't mean all the dairy has to come from cows. The state is also our leading producer of goat milk and, of course, goat cheese. Wyoming. The signature dish is bison or beef jerky. Cowboys on the range have been chewing it for more than 150 years. And who knew? Wyoming is also a fisherman's paradise with more than 70 species of fish, including the state fish, the cutthroat trout. What a delicious book! The Edible Book Festivals honor literary-inspired culinary creations. And this year, one entry really had the judges smacking their lips. It featured a covered bed of salami and cheese etched with a picture of Karl Barks, all sitting on a bed of olives, bread, and assorted finger foods. Its name, the Communist Antipasto. We go from a rather pleasant thing to a rather drastic story. The Last Bad Day. Survivors of the USS Indianapolis spent days bobbing in the sea, enduring sharks, blistering sun, and dehydration. How they conducted themselves in the water and afterward is an affirmation of life. Each summer, as Lake Michigan finally begins to warm, I think of the men in the World War II cruiser U.S. Indianapolis and the worst disaster at sea in U.S. naval history. I go down to the lake and I wonder, how would I have survived what they experienced? I don't know the answer, but it's the asking of the question that helps me recalibrate what could be called my moral compass. On July 30, 1945, just over a month before the end of the war, the ship was torpedoed by a Japanese submarine in the Philippine Sea. It sank in 12 minutes. Of the 1,195 men on board, only 316 were alive when help arrived 4 days later. Headlines of the disaster deeply disturbed Americans. How could this have happened so close to the war's end? Today, only 12 of those men are still living. And each July, they meet in Indianapolis for a reunion, as they have periodically since 1960, to gather around members of shipmates who were lost at sea and those survivors who have recently passed away. According to the Department of Veterans Affairs, about 16 million Americans served in World War II, and of those, about 497,000 are with us today, in our neighborhoods, at our grocery stores, and at a family gathering. Around 350 are dying each day, meaning that sometime within this generation, all will be deceased. And I will mention out of context here that I was at the VA today. I have hearing aids and had to have them adjusted. And I had the pleasure of talking with a 92-year-old World War II veteran who was drafted out of Arkansas in the days before they actually had electricity. They didn't get electricity in his hometown until 1952. We live in a different time. I suspect that we'll feel then that the 20th century has truly ended. We'll no longer be able to walk up to the gentleman we spy on our way to the derrick case, who is wearing a hat bearing the insignia of World War II unit, and shake the hand of someone who fought Hitler. When I first met the survivors of the Indianapolis in 1999, while writing a book about them, their story, the last major action of World War II, was rarely mentioned in high school textbooks. This is despite the fact that before its torpedoing, the ship had delivered components of the atom bomb, Little Boy, to Tinian Island. The bomb parts were packed in plywood case, whose contents the sailors tried vainly to guess, having no idea their ship was delivering the atom to modern warfare. As the men floated in the sea, they were blinded by sun, hounded by hallucinations, thirst, and hunger, attacked by sharks, and beset finally by the realization that no one was coming to rescue them. Some of them purposely swam away to die, feeling all hope was lost. Others surrendered to the moment, but did not give up. An important distinction. While still certain that rescue would never come, they carried on, assisting struggling shipmates even when it didn't seem to matter. By becoming selfless, they apprehended who they were as individuals. When they were miraculously rescued, having been spotted by a 24-year-old pilot named Chuck Gwynn, whom in later years they affectionately called their angel, so they felt they had been reborn. The second half of the 20th century was powered by this restless energy, possessed by millions of other Americans also returning from war. When I asked the survivors about this ordeal on their lives, they consistently remarked that since their rescue, they've never had a bad day. Reflecting on their struggle to survive feels instructive. When I look at Lake Michigan each July, I imagine the men of the Indianapolis visible on the horizon, dark heads, struggling arms, a cry and a whirl of a world being remade. I feel an overwhelming sense of sadness, accompanied by a desire to yell out that they will be rescued. At the same time, I know that many never were, but the sadness always comes. What I feel I'm watching in my mind's eye is the work of people struggling to stay alive, and in the process struggling with what it means to be a moral person, even after they emerge from the crucible of the sea. Captain Charles McVeigh of the Indianapolis was court-martialed, making him the only captain in American history to be court-martialed for losing his ship in an act of war. Gilles McCoy, a founder of the USS Indianapolis Survivors Organization, promised his captain that the Navy would exonerate him one day. But in 1968, outside his stately home in Litchfield, Connecticut, Captain McVeigh took his own life. Survivors and other advocates struggled for years to clear McVeigh's name. When I asked McCoy why his shipmate stood behind the captain, he said, "The skipper never blamed anyone but himself." This is despite the fact that the Japanese submarine commander who had sunk the ship, Mochizuru Hashimoto, testified during the court-martial that there was nothing McKay could have done to stop it. McVeigh, steadfast in his own moral universe, believed otherwise. "Forgive yourself," we want to say, but we know he won't. His sense of duty was profound, and the survivors' efforts to clear his name can be heard as an elegiac counterpoint to the suffering. Finally, on July 13, 2001, 56 years after the ship's sinking, the Navy announced that McVeigh was not culpable for the disaster. "Last night I swam out beyond the buoys, looked up in the sky, and felt the dark, pliable hand of the night water take hold. I do this every year. 5 minutes floating alone in the dark, unable to touch bottom, is the barest glimpse of the ordeal that 316 men of the Indianapolis survived. But I recommend it. Swim out where your bottom swoops to the deep and dog paddle, even though you're certain you're safe. The mind skips a beat, I promise. You tell yourself tomorrow will be a good day." He said, she said, "The only person who listens to both sides of a husband and wife argument is the woman in the next apartment." Okay, let's do a quick humor in uniform here. When the officer stopped in front of me during inspection, I sharply opened the chamber of my rifle and thrust it into his hand. He glanced into the chamber and looked surprised. Inside was a smashed cockroach. Everything has meant trouble, and it did. Nodding to the late bug, the officer announced, "Legs improperly aligned, 6 demerits. My medical unit kept me busy filing reports, many of which clearly didn't apply to us. Here's one example. Personnel trained for B-52 weapons system. When the inspector general learned of this, he ordered us to submit a monthly report of unnecessary reports. Among the first reports to make that list, the report of unnecessary reports. It was 1943, the height of World War II. Reader's Digest ran these examples of military slang to help us understand Johnny's new lingo for when he comes marching home. Armored cow, canned milk. China clipper, dishwasher. Roll up your flaps, stop talking. Sidearms, cream and sugar. Of course, they missed all the really colorful ones, such as blank on a shingle. And with that, let's switch over to the Consumer Reports. Last week, we were talking about the difference, the hidden fees that we all end up getting stuck with and how they're increasing terribly over time. And here's a story of, well, let's do the percentages first. The first was the different percentages for car buying and such. And here's one for car rental. It's not just the extra drop-off charges when you return a car to a different location from where you picked it up. Car rental companies also charge fees for everything from gas to tolls to GPS. Toll transponders. Rental companies often charge extra for the privilege of using their transponder, the thing you stick in your window or dash that lets you pass quickly through tolls. The fix. Before you opt for one, make sure you'll be driving on toll roads. If you are, considering using Waze or Google Maps and click Avoid Toll Routes. Or if you have a transponder on your car at home, check whether you can bring it with you and whether it will work whether you're traveling. Also, check whether the rental company will charge a separate fee for using it. Prepaid fuel. You'll almost always pay a premium when you prepay for fuel. The fix. Ask the car rental staffer where the closest gas station is to your location and plan for extra time to return with a full tank. Facility charges. Some rental companies pass along fees from the airport where you pick up your car, which can range anywhere from a few dollars to $10 or more a day. Some call it an airport concession fee or concession recovery fee. The fix. Though it may not be convenient, you can avoid the fee and sometimes get a lower rate overall by renting from an office a few miles away from the airport. Additional insurance. This extra charge can often be avoided because your personal auto insurance or the credit card you use to pay for the rental may provide extra coverage. Added extra. Before opting for GPS, satellite radio, or another extra, check the card cost and make sure you really need that addition. Credit cards. Sometimes credit cards can help you beat fees. For example, letting you use cash back points to cover checked airline baggage. But they also come with their own set of annoying extra charges. Though it's easy to find cards that don't charge annual fees, and about a quarter did in 2018, it can be hard to avoid some of the other credit card fees. Late payments. Credit cards often punish people for failing to pay the minimum due on time, with late payments fee as high as $38 in 2018, according to creditcards.com. The fix. There are a few cards, such as the Citi Simplicity and the PenFed Promise Visa, that don't charge the fee. For PenFed card, you would need to join the credit union. Better yet, don't be late. Sign up for an automatic minimum payments to put reminders on your phone or calendar. Balance transfers. It can sometimes be smart to transfer the balance on one card to another one with a lower rate, though the cost for that can be steep, 3 to 5% of the transfer amount. The fix, sign up for a card such as the Bank America card for students or Slate from Chase that don't charge for transfers to the first 60 days of card membership. Cash advances. Using your credit card to get cash isn't a great idea because you have to start paying interest right away and there's often a fee of 2% to 5% of the borrowed amount. The fix. One card that doesn't have that fee is the PenFed Promise Visa. Foreign transactions. Using your cards outside the U.S. typically comes with a fee of 3% of the transaction amount, according to creditcards.com. The fix. Use a travel rewards card, such as a Capital One Venture One credit card, which doesn't charge these fees. Hotels. And these are nasty. Being nickel and dimed by unexpected hotel fees is a frequent complaint among modern-day travelers. Hundreds of consumers wrote to us about paying extra for everything from safes they never opened to newspapers they never read to, at least in one case, even bathroom towels. Because third-party websites that let you compare multiple hotels at once don't always show all the fees you might have to pay, it's often worth doing some extra homework. The fix, start by checking hotel websites directly. Sometimes list the fees they typically charge. But call the hotel, too, to get a full tally of fees and to ask about waivers for services you know you'll never use. That is more likely to work if you call before checking in. And if you get the name of the hotel staffer you talk to in the case of disputes later. Two other options. Check fees at specific hotels at resortfeechecker.com. That's resortfeechecker.com. And consider joining a hotel loyalty program. Pearl Level members of MGM Resorts loyalty program get complimentary self-parking, and Gold members of the Wyndham Rewards program don't have to pay extra for late checkouts. Here's a sampling of some hotel fees you might encounter. Resort fees. This charge, which typically covers access to things like swimming pools or gyms, even if you never jump in or break a sweat, are a particularly common gripe. The charge averaged about $27 a day in 2018, according to the American Hotel and Lodging Association. Parking fee. Some hotels charge this even if you park yourself, as Jean Harrington of Torrance, California, discovered. That fee, plus others, ended up making her total 25% above the advertised rate, she says. Safe fee. There's an extra charge for that thing hidden in the hotel room closets that many people never use, and some don't even realize is there. The charge is sometimes just a few dollars, but is particularly maddening, one consumers told us. Online reservations or boarding fees. Patricia Doherty of Aurora, Illinois, told us that after a three-day stay at a hotel, she was fined to find a $25 per night fee charged because she had booked her reservation online. Needless to say, I submitted a review reflecting my disappointment with the billing practice, she says. And Robert Jasinski of Eureka Springs, Arkansas, says he was surprised by a reservation fee he had to pay at a Colorado hotel whenever he reserved the room online or on the phone. Wi-Fi fees. Though many hotels now provide free internet, you may have to pay a premium for high-speed connections. That's what Roger Brawl of Cypress, Texas, says happened to him during a trip to San Francisco. So apparently the Wi-Fi wasn't free after all, he says. Investments. This is one area of financial life where fees are actually dropping. Financial service companies competing for customers have slashed their fees, especially for index funds. But you still need to be wary. Some services remain costly, and even small fees can, over time, cut big time into your investments. Account management. The average annual fee or expense ratio for mutual funds is now just 0.52%, but some charge twice that amount. The fix, opt for low-cost index funds from firms such as Fidelity, Schwab, or Vanguard that have fees at 0.2% or less. Or consider exchange-traded funds, ETFs, which may charge 0.1% or less. Over the long run, that could boost your return by hundreds of thousands of dollars. Sales charges. Brokers may be more likely to pitch investments with high upfront sales charges of 2% or more, and to have offerings with other fees, such as account maintenance fees, that could run $100 more a year. The fix, considering a robo-advisory firm such as Betterment or Wealthfront, computer-driven services that design and manage portfolios for a 0.25%, or offer a low-cost target date retirement fund, which provides a mix that becomes more conservative as you're near retirement. Advice. Many financial advisors levy an annual fee of 1% on your assets on top of the fund expense ratios. The fix, hire a certified financial planner who charges by the hour or a flat fee. Find lists of such advisors to the National Association of Personal Financial Advisors, NAFTA organization, or the Garrett Planning Network, GarrettPlanningNetwork.com. Utilities. These are the several parts to your utility bill, including the supply charge for electricity or gas you actually use, and a fixed fee which you pay before the water even starts running. If you're like many Americans, you may be trying to save money on your supply charge by being more energy efficient. The problem, some utility companies are trying to compensate for that lost income by jacking up fixed fees. Consider John Skelly, a retired physical therapist in Valley Cottage, New York. He has switched to LED light bulbs and energy efficient appliances and even installed solar panels. But he says my gas and electric company charges $20 per month in fixed charges for each utility, regardless of how much energy I use, and even if I use none at all. Such fees are becoming more common. From 2015 to 2018, utilities made 158 proposals to state utility commissioners to impose or increase fees. According to Samantha Williams, who tracks the issue for the National Resources Defense Council, and 31 affiliates in 18 states asked for an increase of at least 100%. They appear near the top of the list of unexpected fees that Americans experienced, according to CR's recent survey. But relief may be on the way, Williams says. Last year, state energy commissions rejected 38% of the fixed fee hike proposals. That's up from 25% in 2017. The fix. In most places, you can't shop around for your gas or electricity, so your best option is to demand that your public service commissioner reject utilities' proposed fee hikes. Do that by contacting the commission in your state, signing a petition, or attending a public hearing. Utilities may think they can get away with raising customer fees, but they won't if you speak up, says Sharon Bilker-Bronsteyer, CR's Senior Policy Counsel for Energy and Environment. Americans who experienced hidden or unexpected utility fees in the past 2 years, 48% in the Northeast and 39% in the rest of the country. A year in fees, one family's story. We estimated what an American family, two parents and two kids in Pittsburgh, might spend over the course of 1 year in fees associated with entertainment, travel, and a new car. Other fees not included here include those related to banking, credit cards, utilities, and more. Airfare, 4 round-trip tickets to Orlando, Florida, booked on American Airlines. Ticket prices were $437.20 each for a total of $1,748.80. 2 check bags at $30 each, rounded up, round-trip, $120. 2 seat upgrades one-way, $136. 2 Wi-Fi connections round-trip for $40, for a total fees of $296, in addition to their airfare. Hotel, 6 nights at the Wyndham Grand Orlando Beach, Bonnet Creek. The room cost was $1,214. Resort fee of $35 per day was $210. Parking fee of $22 per day was $130, for an additional $342 above the $1,214. Car rental. Mazda 3 from Hertz in Orlando, Florida for 1 week with airport pickup booked directly. Rental cost was $273.05. The fees. Privilege fee recovery charge of $28.30. Customer facility charge of $21. That's because of the airport. State surcharge of $12.12. Vehicle licensing fee recovery, $8.41. Energy surcharge of $1.49. Bypass for transponder, $41.65. Total fees were $112.97. Baseball games. 4 upper-level tickets to 2 Pittsburgh Pirate games. Ticket price of $25.50 each thing, $204. Fees per ticket via Stubwing, $7.10, for a total of $56.80. That's not too bad. A concert. 4 upper-level tickets to go Ariana Grande concert. Ticket price of $214 each. That's $856. The fees were service fee per ticket, $44.94. That's $179 above. Cable, 1 year of Xfinity for cable TV. Cable service is $1,260. Broadcast fees for monthly fees for broadcast TV fee, $10. Regional sports fee, $8.25. DVR service fee of $10. HD technology fee for $9.95. Total fees monthly, $38.20. Total fees annually, $458.40. That's above the $1,260. A car purchase, a Honda CR-V EX. Sales price, $27,999. Licensing and registration funds. License and registration, $185. Documentation fee, $144. Prep fee, $200. Accessory, Lux Care, interior and exterior protection package, you could skip this if you want to, was $989. VIN etching loan, VIN etching, that can be skipped too for $200. Advertising fee can skip for $300. Total non-negotiable or avoidable fees, $1,833. Total fees for the year were $3,278.78. What the fee? No more hidden fees, period. This is Consumer Reports requests. Consumer Reports is working with Americans across the country to encourage companies, regulators, and lawmakers to end hidden fees. We believe all mandatory fees should be included in the base price, and add-on fees should be reasonable and disclosed up front. Together, we are making progress in South Carolina. Consumer sales scale back a 238% proposed hike in fixed fees on utility fees. As the Federal Trade Commission looks into an online event, ticket sales, more than 6,000 consumers weighed in with their stories and concerns about the fees. More than 130,000 of you signed a CR petition protesting the cable industry's billing practices, and several members of Congress noticed, including the True Fees Act, requiring cable and internet companies to include all charges in the advertising price. Want to help end the fee economy? Go to whatthefee.com to report unexpected fees or share how you fought back. And it's interesting, I just bought movie tickets yesterday, and it was a discounted day, so the tickets were only $6.75 apiece, but there was a $3.40 service charge, which means that nearly 20% of the cost of the tickets was service fees. Smart Summertime Solutions. Is your sunscreen safe? The FDA is bringing a new level of scrutiny to ingredients in sunscreens, but the jury is still out on what changes may result. So the best way to protect, no matter what your skin tone, is to use CR's ratings to find the most effective products and to adopt other sun safety habits. This season, there's some big news in the world of sunscreen. For the first time in 20 years, the Food and Drug Administration has proposed new ways for sunscreens to be regulated. If these rules, which include possible restrictions on the ingredients allowed in sunscreens, as well as on the types of products on the market, are enacted, it could affect how you choose to protect your skin. While none of these proposals have been finalized, they have ignited debates about the safety and effectiveness of sunscreens and the proper way to use them. Even if various changes aren't eventually enacted, the FDA's proposal raises points that consumers need to be aware of, says Don Huber, Director of Product Safety at Consumer Reports. The FDA's updated rules aim to correct some issues that CRs has previously expressed concern about, such as the accuracy of a sunscreen's listed sun protection factor, SPF, and the safety of spray sunscreens. Shining a light on safety. The FDA's new proposal came as a result of the Sunscreen Innovation Act, passed by Congress in 2014. The act required a new process for evaluating the safety and effectiveness of sunscreens. The part of the plan that has generated the most buzz is the FDA's call for the sunscreen industry to provide more information on 12 common chemical active ingredients, including avobenzone, homosalate, oxytetroxate, oxalate, oxyxylene, and oxybenzone. These can be absorbed through the skin, and some experts are concerned that the chemicals may lead to hormonal disruption and reproductive problems in skin cancer. This request for additional data does not mean that the FDA has concluded that these 12 ingredients are unsafe, says Teresa Michelle, MD, Director of the Division of Non-Prescription Drug Products at the FDA. The goal here is to get the data and validate the safety and effectiveness of all these ingredients. The FDA has long classified these ingredients as generally recognized as safe and effective, a designation indicating that the ingredient doesn't need to be approved by the FDA to be used in a product. But the way consumers use sunscreen has changed over the years. People now use sunscreen more often, says Henry Lim, MD, a dermatologist at Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit and former president of the American Academy of Dermatology. That raises the question of whether ingredients that were thought to be safe when used occasionally, once or twice a week at the beach or pool, for instance, could be harmful in larger daily doses. Oxybenzone questions. Of the 12 chemical ingredients under review, oxybenzone is possibly the most concerning. Researchers have found detectable levels of oxybenzone in human blood and breast milk, and there is some evidence that it can harm coral reefs. But it might not be the only sunscreen ingredient to do so. One study, for example, found that the natural ingredient zinc oxide could cause coral damage as well. The American Academy of Pediatrics advises parents to avoid using sunscreens with oxybenzone on children if possible. Studies in laboratory animals and other laboratory studies show that the chemical can mimic the actions of hormones that naturally occur in the human body, says Sophie J. Bach, MD, an attending pediatrician at the Children's Hospital at Montefiore in the Bronx, New York, and a member of the AAP Council on Environmental Health. Still, none of this means oxybenzone has been found to be unsafe. We do know that the chemical is absorbed into the bloodstream, but we don't know exactly what, if any, effect it's having, says Stephen G. Wang, MD, Director of Dermatology and Dermatological Surgery at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in Basking Ridge, New Jersey. This ingredient has been used in sunscreen for 40 years, Wang says, And it says that to date, no human studies have found evidence of harm. The CR's recommended lotions and sprays contain oxybenzone for important reasons. Our ratings are based on sunscreen's ability to filter out UVA and UVB rays, on how closely the tested SPF matches the SPF on the label. Oxybenzone is a very good UVA filter. It also helps to stabilize other active ingredients so they remain effective longer than they otherwise would. Still, in our ratings, there are 13 oxybenzone-free sunscreens that, though not top scores, do provide a very good overall protection. We've highlighted them in our ratings, and we'll touch on that. Should you go natural? If chemical ingredients are being scrutinized, you may think the solution is to switch to a natural sunscreen that contains only the mineral active ingredients titanium oxide and or zinc oxide. Indeed, the FDA isn't currently questioning the safety and effectiveness of these ingredients. But in CR's testing, these sunscreens consistently underperformed. None of the 17 mineral sunscreens in our current rating scored high enough to receive a recommended designation from CR, or even to get an overall score of very good. We think you would get the best sun protection by choosing one of our high-scoring products, Huber says. However, for those who want to use a mineral sunscreen, our tests show that California Kids Super Sensitive Lotion SPF 30+, Badger Active Natural Mineral Cream SPF 30 unscented, and Goddess Garden Everyday Natural Lotion SPF 30 offer some protection, though not as much as our top-rated products. Other protective strategies. Despite the FDA's concern about sunscreen ingredients, one thing is clear. It's absolutely vital that you continue to use sunscreen when heading outside. There is overwhelming evidence that sunscreen protects against skin cancer and other harmful effects of the sun, so consumers need to continue to use it while scientists do more research on the safety of its ingredients, Huber says. On a way to minimize any potential problems with oxybenzone or any other sunscreen ingredient is to cover up, something everyone should be doing anyway. Your sun protection plan should never be just about sunscreen, says Mona Gohara, MD, Associate Clinical Professor of Dermatology at the Yale School of Medicine in New Haven, Connecticut. Even if you apply it enough, 1 ounce or a shot glass to cover your whole body, and reapply consistently every 2 hours or right after you get out of the water, no sunscreen blocks 100% of the ultraviolet rays, and covering up wearing long sleeves and a hat, for example, leaves fewer exposed areas to apply sunscreen to, so you use less. Along with seeking the shade and staying out of the sun during peak hours, it's maybe a good healthy practice. I should have ended that. It maybe is a good healthy practice, period. How to speak sunscreen. The language sunscreen labels can be hard to decipher. But to ensure the best sun protection, it's important to know exactly what you're getting. Much of what you see on the label is marketing, which can make it difficult to decode what's truly main fuel, says Joshua Sickner, MD, Director of Cosmetic and Clinical Research at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City. Here's what some of the most common terms on your sunscreen label really mean. SPF. This stands for Sun Protection Factor. It measures only how well the sunscreen protects from UVB rays, the ones primarily responsible for sunburn. SPF 15 blocks 93% of the UVB rays. SPF 30 blocks 97%. SPA 50 blocks 98%. Broad spectrum. Seeing this term, which is regulated by the Food and Drug Administration, on the label, means that the product contains ingredients that help to shield the skin from ultraviolet A and B rays. UVA rays accelerate age-related skin damage and largely contribute to the risk of melanoma, the deadliest form of skin cancer. Water resistant. According to the FDA standards, this means the sunscreen has been tested and will maintain its SPF level for 40 minutes while swimming or sweating. Very water resistant means it contains its SPF level for 80 minutes. However, you still need to apply sunscreen when you get out of the water. Protects against aging and skin cancer. This is not a regulated term, but it's safe to say that if used properly, any broad-spectrum sunscreen with an SPF of 30 or higher will help to protect you from skin aging and skin cancer. Proper use involves applying enough sunscreen, a teaspoon per body part, such as the torso or leg, reapplying it every 12 hours while you're in the sun, and using it in combination with other sun protection measures. Sport. You'll find this on products marketed to people who want a sunscreen that stays put during vigorous outdoor activity. The term isn't regulated by the FDA. Baby or kid. There are dozens of sunscreens that manufacturers say are designed just for babies and kids, but there is no FDA regulation that governs who can use these terms and how. You'll often see this label on sunscreen designed to be less irritating to young skin by virtue of containing only mineral active ingredients, zinc oxide and titanium oxide. Dermatologists tested or approved. This is a marketing term that is unregulated and mostly meaningless. A dermatologist may have been consulted about the product or tried it, but there's no way for the consumer to know what, if any, kind of testing was performed. Saving face. Sunscreen's label as being for your face protects your skin exactly the same way, with the same active ingredients as sunscreens for the body do. But these products are formulated to suit those with special facial skin concerns. For example, many are oil-free, which is a help to those with oily or acne-prone complexions. Oil-free products are also usually lighter, which allows them to be used under makeup without feeling greasy. In addition, facial sunscreens often have no fragrance or just a light scent. Fragrances are one of the major causes of skin irritation, so that's a plus if you have sensitive skin. But whether you use a face sunscreen, a body sunscreen, or a moisturizer with SPF, you need to follow these tips to make sure you're fully covered. Use enough. A fingertip-sized blob won't do. You need a teaspoon-sized blob to properly cover your face and neck. Don't count on moisturizers or makeups with SPF. You probably don't apply enough of either to protect your skin. In a new study published by the journal PLOS ONE, study participants who used SPF moisturizer were more likely to miss areas around the eyes, a common site for skin cancer, than when they used a regular sunscreen. As for makeup, it's almost impossible to use enough to get effective coverage from SPF foundation without looking like you're applied a mask. People don't apply foundation evenly. They don't apply it everywhere, and they don't apply enough for it to be adequate protection on its own. Says Jeannie Down, MD, a dermatologist and an assistant attending physician at Mountainside Hospital in Montclair, New Jersey, and Overhook Hospital in Summit, New Jersey. Also worth noting, SPF isn't cumulative. Using an SPF 15 foundation on top of an SPF 15 moisturizer does not add up to SPF 30. Reapply. Sunscreens need to be reapplied every 2 hours to continue to be effective. Even if you're just sitting in your office all morning, it's inactivated in a couple of hours, says Macrine Alexidias, MD, PhD, and Associate Clinical Professor of Dermatology at the Yale School of Medicine in New Haven, Connecticut. So reapply before heading out at lunch. If you don't want to mess with your makeup, keep a wide-brim hat at your desk and put it on before you go outside. The sunscreen of the future. If the Food and Drug Administration's proposed sunscreen rules take effect, consumers will see some changes in all labels and the types of products available. Here's what's under consideration. SPF claims will be capped at 60. Sunscreens with SPF of 75 to 100 may lead consumers to think they can stay in the sun longer or that they don't need to reapply. But if the FDA says there's no data showing that SPF's higher than 60 are more protective, in addition, sunscreens would not be able to be formulated with an SPF higher than 80. Sunscreens be SPF 61 and SPF 80 won't be able to use the higher number on the label. All would be labeled SPF 60+. Some experts think that higher SPFs help to compensate for user errors. People don't apply the same amount of sunscreen that's used when the companies are testing the SPF, says Harry Lim, MD, a dermatologist of Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit. That means a product labeled SPF 30 might deliver only SPF 15. Still, SPF 60+ should be enough to overcome less than ideal user application. New tests will be required. Under the FDA's proposal, sunscreen manufacturers will have to give their sunscreens the lowest SPF their tests show within a range. For example, a sunscreen that tests between 40 and 49 may be required to be labeled SPF 40 in CR's test. Many sunscreens fell short of their advertised SPF. We strongly support this part of the proposal because it will help cut down on the times when manufacturers promise more protection than they can deliver, says William Wallace, manager of home and product policy at Consumer Reports. In addition, the requirements for labeling sunscreen broad spectrum, which means the product protects against ultraviolet A and B rays, will be strengthened. Even among products that qualify as a broad spectrum by the FDA's current standards, the actual levels of UVA protection vary greatly. That's why CR rates a sunscreen's level of UVA protection. The problem is that the SPF of a product goes up. It's not a given that the UVA coverage also increases, says CR's Don Huber. Indeed, under current FDA rules, you could have a broad-spectrum SPF with a better UVA coverage than a broad-spectrum SPF 30. Certain product types could be eliminated. If the proposed changes take effect, certain forms of sunscreen products will no longer be available. These include SPF wipes, towelettes, body washes, and shampoos, and possibly sunscreen insect repellent combinations. Because sunscreen needs to be applied and reapplied liberally, using a combo product could expose you to too much of the active ingredient in the insect repellent, or the interaction of sunscreen active ingredients with repellent active ingredients could enhance the absorption of one or both. Sunscreen sprays and powders will also come under more scrutiny. Sprays can be flammable until they dry, and the FDA is proposing that manufacturers test the drying time and label products accordingly. Sprays would also be subject to new restrictions on the size of the particles and them to help minimize the risk of inhalation. For this reason, CR recommends not using spray sunscreens on kids unless no other product is available, Huber says. Powdered sunscreens will face similar restrictions on particle sizes, and the FDA is asking for more data on the safety and effectiveness. Well, unfortunately, we are just about out of time, but I will run through the first few of the different types of sunscreens with the highest rating. La Roche-Posay Anthelio 60, Bullfrog Land Sports Quick, Copper Tone Ultra Guard Lotion, Equate from Walmart, Copper Tone Defend and Care, Copper Tone Water Babies Pure and Simple, Neutrogena Cool Dry Sport Lotion, CVS Ultra Protection Sun Lotion, Neutrogena Ultra Sheer Dry Touch Lotion, Salmimo Amazon General Protection Lotion, Walgreens Hydrogen Lotion, and Orion Tropic Sheer Touch. And a couple of sticks, Up and Up by Target for Kids Sunscreen Stick, Neutrogena Beach Defense Water and Sun Protection Stick, and Banana Boat Ultra Defense Sunscreen Stick all got good ratings. And a quick point to ponder, and then we're going ahead and close. You have those moments where you reflect whether you're at driving the car, in the plane, whatever, and you say, no matter what I'm going through in life, at the moment from where I came from and where I am now, you know what? Life ain't so bad. Drain Wade, athlete. And with that, we've just about run out of time for today's broadcast of the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, which hasn't changed, TriangleReadingService.org. We'd like to thank all of our past sponsors for their generous contributions to the Reading Service. If you have any comments or questions or would like to be a sponsor, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, Reader for Triangle.